Okay, for today's second class, we have our brother Mark Vincent. His theme for the week has been, How Readest Thou? And he's titled today's class, The Big Picture.
So how do you do Bible study? Because it's quite a forbidding thing, isn't it? Even if you decide, if you decide to yourself, right, I think it'd be a good thing to study the Bible, so I'm going to sit down and do some. So you sit down there with your Bible, and then what happens after that? It's a little scary. And the thing that I want to emphasize, really, and hopefully this will come out during the course of will have come out or will be coming out during the course of the week, is that it's not a black art. You know, there's no incredibly complex or involved process that is needed to study the Bible. And I think if I look back at my own experience, I probably started studying the Bible seriously, I guess, when I was in my early teens, and I did a lot of sort of elaborate stuff, a lot of looking at words in concordances, looking up lexicons, doing quite fancy and laborious stuff, and it would take me, I would write all this material and about some word or other word. And I look back at it now, and I think it was largely a waste of time, in that there was a sort of, didn't really get me anywhere. It didn't lead to any great insights. It wasn't a waste of time in the sense that maybe I had to go through that to realize there's actually a better way of studying the Bible. So, you know, it was valuable in that it brought me to a place that was better, I think. But there's a lot of Bible study of the type, you know, this word is this, and if you look up the original, it means this, and here are some places where it occurs. And sometimes, you know, a word is just a word, and there's nothing, there's not a huge amount to be gained by spending 3 hours looking up in lots of different books about it. So, you know, you don't need to have a great library like this of lexicons and fancy books in order to do Bible study. Bible study, I think, is basically about, you know, it starts with good Bible reading. It starts with asking the right questions. And you remember those two questions that we asked yesterday that I think are critical questions. Why is this in the Bible? And what difference does it make? You know, how would the Bible have been different if this wasn't here? What's its function? What's it telling me about God? What's it telling me about myself? What's it telling me about God's purpose and the way that I should live? And if we always keep those questions in our minds when we read the Bible, then I think we're likely to be more productive when we read it. One thing that's important, I think, is to get the big picture. One of the mistakes I made is that I remember doing a study of Obadiah, and I thought to myself, right, I'm going to do some Bible study. Pick a nice short book. So I picked Obadiah, and Obadiah starts, let's have a look how it starts. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumour from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. So I remember looking at the word vision there, and spending a lot of time analysing the word vision. And then you go into rumour, You know, that's a bit of a strange word there, isn't it? We have heard a rumor from the Lord. You know, is God, does God really spread rumors? And of course, the answer to that is no. Rumor's just an old English translation, or not a very good translation. If you look at it in a modern version, it says something like, have you got it there, Paul? Have you got your NIV today? Has anyone got a version with a different word there for rumor?
Yeah.
Message?
Tidings.
Okay. And so all you need to do on this word is find out that basically it doesn't mean rumor as we think about it. It means a message. This is the message. We've heard a message from the Lord concerning Edom. And really, that's all you need to do. And it may be that if you go 10 levels deep, it may be that there's something else going on there. But, you know, at first, if you're doing a study of Obadiah, don't spend 6 hours looking at the word rumor. Just work out, okay, it's not really a rumor, it's about a message. And once you understand that that's what it means, then you can move on. And looking at a couple of different Bible translations, so if we're predominantly using the AV, which I do, and which most of you do, and since a lot of the concordances and tools are based on it, that's another good reason for doing so. That was one we didn't mention the other day. And then you've got a couple of other modern versions as well, maybe the ESV or the RSV, maybe an NIV as well. You can pretty soon get a picture of, you know, if there's a word like that that's just not got a very helpful translation to it. An ambassador is sent among the nations. Arise ye and let us rise up against her in battle. But so what I did was I spent so long investigating this word vision and this word rumor that I don't think I ever even made it to verse 6 because I was too busy on verse 1. Well, at least I was being methodical, I suppose, but it wasn't the best way of doing things. I mean, what is important in this verse? This is a vision of Obadiah about Edom, and an ambassador is being sent to the nations with a message. So we're going to want to know, well, what is this message that this ambassador is taking to the nations? And Edom, why should there be a prophecy here about Edom? What's the significance of Edom? So a better way of studying Obadiah here, if only I'd known that 18 years ago or whatever it was, would have been to say, okay, so this is a prophecy about Edom. So it's going to help me, actually, if I know something about Edom. If I've got a little bit of background about Edom, then that's going to be useful, because once I start to read Obadiah, I know I'm going to expect that I'm going to find things that are going to plug into what I've just learned about Edom. So I better go and find out a little bit about Edom. So what do? You get your dictionary out, you find out a bit of the history of Edom, you look up your concordance, you find out who Edom is, where Edom came from, what the history was, what God might have against Edom or pro-Edom. And then you've got a context in which now to start to understand the prophecy of Obadiah. Then what would you do? Well, how about reading it? It would be a good idea. So read Obadiah, and then read it again, and then read it again, and then read it again. And, you know, you probably can't read it too many times, actually. And I think read it in different versions. Get familiar with it. Get so it almost becomes part of you, so that you almost know, you know, the next thing that's going to come before you're actually reading it. Because then your mind will sort of start to get in tune with where Obadiah is coming from. And that will be very helpful. And you'll start to get the big picture about the prophecy, about where it's going, how it moves, what the message is. You can never read a passage that you're studying too much, I don't think. So I really want to bang on about that point. You know, if you're studying an epistle, if you're studying the book of Isaiah, which is what we're doing in what I'm doing in my session on the adult class, just read it and read it and read it again. You know, read it, write down what you remember about it. Read it again, write down some new things that you didn't remember the first time. Write down what questions you have. Write down which bits of it you don't understand. Write down what it is that you don't understand. And write down, and then think about, what could I do so that I could start to understand this bit that I don't understand? And then you've got sort of a list of tasks then about what you can do. So that's pretty critical. It's pretty critical to get the big picture of a book. One of the things that I think Christadelphians, one of the mistakes that I think Christadelphians have made consistently in Bible study is diving into details at such depth that you miss overall what's going on. You know, so focusing on a word and missing the big picture. Wood and the trees type thing. And the process of just reading through and reading through helps you avoid that mistake. Well, let's take that principle of trying to get the big picture and let's apply it to 1 Corinthians. So can you turn to 1 Corinthians? So yesterday we looked at Jonah, and the reason why we looked at Jonah, you remember, was because it was a familiar story to us, and yet we wanted to think about what else is there going on behind the obvious story, and why would that be an important message to include in the Bible. So today we're going to look at one of the letters. Obviously the New Testament has a lot of letters in it. Why does the Bible have letters in it? Why do you have... One of the things about... You know when you sit in a room and someone's on the telephone and you can hear half the conversation and you can hear what the person in the room with you is saying, but you can't hear what the person is saying on the other end of the line, and you can sort of work it out, can't you? A little bit. You can back out what the other person must have said something, you know. So the person in the room says, "Yeah, I think it's going to rain tomorrow." Then you know that maybe the thing that the person said before was maybe we shouldn't go to the park or whatever, I don't know, or ask what the weather was or something. You know, there's a limited range of options of what the person before must have said in order for someone to respond, "Yeah, I think it's going to rain tomorrow." Similarly with the letters, we've got half the story. We've got the apostle's inspired response, but what we don't have is what originally triggered that letter. So one of the things that we can do with the letters is to try to reconstruct them. We're in 1 Corinthians, so if you can turn to 1 Corinthians, that would be good. So what we're going to do, we're each going to take a chapter and we're going to read it and write down what goes on in that chapter and what you think the problem was that Paul was addressing. So Corinthians is a letter which is written to address a whole load of problems of what was taking place in the Corinthian ecclesia. We're going to try to reverse engineer the letter now and say, well, given that Paul said that, what must the problem have been, or what must have been going on in Corinth for Paul to respond in that way? Okay? So what happens in this chapter? What's the problem that makes Paul respond in that way? So I'm going to give you each a chapter. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 1, 2, 3. So if you can take your chapter... And if you can't remember what your chapter was, ask the person next to you what theirs was and reverse engineer that. And just make a list. What's this chapter about? What do you think the problem must have been that made Paul write what he wrote? Obviously, chapter 15 is huge. If you happen to be doing chapter 15, you're going to need to speed read that one. You don't have to write a lot, just a couple of bullets maybe on each part of that. What's the chapter about? What's the problem that Paul is probably addressing? Okay, let's see what we got. Can you put your hand up if you were chapter 1 person? Okay, great. So do you want to tell us some of the things in chapter 1 that struck you? Do you want to kick off? Ecclesial problems, yep. Is it clear yet what those problems are or not yet? Divisions, okay. So let's note that down. So chapter 1, we've got divisions. Yep. The introduction. Okay, yeah, the introduction. Let's not worry about the introduction. That's fine. So, we'd expect all the letters to have an introduction and a conclusion. So there may be some clues in there if we were doing a lot of detailed work, but just broadly, we can probably ignore that. Yeah. The message of the cross. Yep. Okay. Yep. Divisions, quarrels, yep. Anything else that you want to add as any other problems? Or, yeah?
People were saying that they were baptized from certain people and they were left calling that name.
Right. So I'm this kind of, I'm associated with him because I was baptized by him. I'm part of a different party. So you get this, you get these factions then in the ecclesia. You know, I'm this type. And, yeah, go.
Like the last section, we see talking about, like, the flesh is not from the spirit, or something, like that, the wise and foolish, or something.
Okay. Talks about wisdom and foolishness, doesn't it? Yeah. We'll just note that here to make sure we come back to it. Okay, good. So we got a broad sense in chapter 1 there. There's nothing else critical that you want to add? No, you're happy with that? Good. So we know we've got divisions in the ecclesia. We've got groups of people who do things one way or associate with a particular brother or set of ideas, and we've got ecclesias who have some different... we've got groups who have some different ideas. Anyone see any relevance in that? No, I'm not gonna ask you to answer that question. But you know, we're human beings. This sort of thing happens. So already we can see this actually might be relevant, even though this letter is 2,000 years old. This might be quite relevant. Let's go on to chapter 2. Who are our chapter 2 people? You must be one. Any other chat? Have we got any chat? Yeah, great. Okay. Do you wanna kick off? Fantastic. Yeah. So let's bring this wisdom point to the fore now then for chapter 2. And it's there already in chapter 1, you're absolutely right. Let's call it wisdom and spirituality. Yeah. Okay. Anything else that's important to add from you other guys? Yeah.
It seems like there's some sort of problem with people giving like fancy speeches that are good, but like good speeches, but just man's wisdom.
Right.
Paul's saying like that's lousy. My speeches might have been lousy as far as oratory goes, but they were smarter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of presentation. So if we back out that, then we've obviously got some kind of superiority problem, haven't we, in this ecclesia, where you've got some people who probably are very eloquent, probably are good orators, who are claiming to have some wisdom, And it's at the level we're at the moment, it's not clear whether they're saying, well, we're wise and, you know, people out there are foolish and sort of despising them, or whether it's, well, you know, this group, our group of brothers are wise, but those brothers, they don't really know what they're talking about. We don't know which of those it is yet, but we know that we've got a problem with some group claiming to have this superior wisdom, superior knowledge. And Paul is saying it's not about cleverness. The basis of what we believe is about something which is completely contradictory to human notions of pride and cleverness. It's, our salvation is based on something that appears foolish from a human point of view. You know, having someone die on a cross does not seem a powerful and strong thing to do. It seems a thing of foolishness and weakness. And yet that is how God has chosen to save the world. So if I'm sort of sticking my chest out and saying, well, I'm pretty smart, and you know, I have all these insights that some other people maybe don't have, then I'm undermining the very basis on which God has saved me. And that's one of the things that he's pointing out. Okay, let's go to chapter 3. Can we have our chapter 3 people put their hands up? We appear to have lost some chapter 3s. Okay, do you want to kick off? Okay, so he's talking about their church, the Corinthian church, you think, yeah. Okay, and do you want to add anything? Okay. I don't think I can do anything about it. Oh, it's this one. Okay. And so we got the factions again, yeah? The divisions. So Paul's coming back to the same problem. He's saying there's lots of unchristlike behavior in the church. And you see there in verse 18, you've got this wisdom and foolishness again, pretty clearly, that we picked up in chapter 2. And he also introduces the idea of judgment, doesn't he? That, you know, this does matter. If you're behaving in this kind of way, that does matter, because there is going to be God is going to call our behavior and our actions to account. Okay, chapter 4. Who have we got at the back for chapter 4? Yeah? Yep. So pride, yeah? Any other problems in chapter 4? Okay. Yep. You've got the party thing going on again, haven't you, in there as well? Talks about that in verse 6. And it's interesting when he talks about the pride there. Have a look at chapter 4 and verse 8. Now ye are full, now ye are rich, ye have reigned as kings without us, and I would to God ye did reign, that we also might reign with you. For I think that God hath set forth us the apostles last, as it were appointed to death, for we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels, and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake. Verses 8 to 10 there. What do you think is going on in those verses? That's for anybody, not just our chapter 4 people. What do you think his message is there? It It's a bit strange, isn't it? It's not easy one, an easy one there. Yeah.
Sounds like they're criticizing the apostles.
Right. Right. So, and we're going to come back to this. This will come up in several more chapters where Paul is defending himself. And it's ironic because normally when someone attacks you, you defend yourself by saying, no, actually, I'm good at whatever it is, don't you? You know, you've criticized me for being bad at something, but actually I'm good. But here, Paul sort of does the opposite of that and says they're criticizing him. And he's saying, well, what I'm proud about is not that I'm good at this, that, or the other, but that I'm suffering for Christ's sake. And almost as if to say, I'm glad when I get beat up for Christ's sake. Do you see how that turns it upside down? And that cuts right against their pride, doesn't it? This pride that you picked up, absolutely right. You know, this aren't I smart thing. And Paul's saying, well, if that's your attitude, you've got no place here. And Christ suffered, didn't he? And we're meant to follow in his footsteps. And that's what Paul wants to do. Paul wants to get as close in his own life as he possibly can to the sufferings of Christ so that he experiences what Christ experienced, which is a pretty incredible thing to say. So a lot of that chapter as well is about defending the apostles' credentials and saying being a servant of God isn't, you know, it's about weakness. It's about suffering for Christ's sake. Let's go on to chapter 5. What's the problem in chapter 5? Yeah? Sorry, I didn't hear that. Okay, yeah. And specifically, there's a specific problem in here? Yeah? Okay. So, yeah? Mm-hmm. Yep. So there's a particular case of this. There's a particular case of incest, isn't there, in the ecclesia? So let's call it misconduct not addressed. Not addressed. So he's saying that God calls us to high standards of sexual purity and it's not acceptable to have this circumstance in the ecclesia. The ecclesia should have addressed it. In fact, they're taking the view, you know, actually we're quite a sophisticated ecclesia because we can, you know, we can deal with having this in our ecclesia. You know, we've kind of risen above this sort of thing being an issue for us. And Paul's saying, no. God calls us to a very high standard. Good. Chapter 6. Yep.
Similar to chapter 1, with like the quarrels. They were having quarrels internally.
Yep.
With the brothers going to law with the other brothers. And they were trying to solve it externally with like judging. They were being judged by people in the world. That was, it says in verse 9, like those people that were judging them, some of them wouldn't even be in the kingdom. So how can you go and be judged by that?
Yep. Only one judge, that's God. Okay. Yep. Good. Any other additions to chapter 6? Yep, I think that's fine for chapter 6. Chapter 7. Who have we got at the back doing chapter 7? Do you want to tell us what you got in chapter 7?
It's about the principles of marriage and keeping a marriage vow. Right.
Okay, great. Yep. So again, why would Paul say that? Well, presumably, they didn't understand very well, or there's some confusion there about what marriage is about, and again about let's call it marriage and sex. So Paul sets out how all that works, what's acceptable and what isn't. Pretty clear what the problems are there that he's addressing, I think. That's great. Chapter 8. Paul?
Where it talks about eating meat that was offered to idols. And he says it's not best, it's not a question. If it is together,
then it's the intention. Right. So giving offense. That's fine. Chapter 9. Yep.
It's kind of about how they were providing for some of the apostles, but not all of them.
Okay.
Verse 6. It says, "Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living?"
Okay. Let's have a look at this. Let's have a look at this. 3, "Mine answer to them that do examine me is this." So what does that suggest? That suggests, again, that Paul himself is being undermined, doesn't it? So his authority is being questioned, and it seems like when Paul's saying, you know, I have a right to behave in this way as an apostle. I have a right to have food provided for me or whatever. But I've not even done that. I've not even taken advantage of those things that are perfectly reasonable for me to take advantage of. For me to take advantage of. So they're obviously criticizing him for sponging off them, for using the gospel as a way to get a free meal or free accommodation or something, and he's saying, "That is my right in the gospel as a minister of God, and I've not even taken up that right." So Paul's defending his authority against the attacks against him. Anything else in chapter 9? You see that point in verse 15. "But I have used none of these things. Neither have I written these things that it should be so done unto me." So most of chapter 9 is about Paul defending himself then from accusations that are made against him. Chapter 10. Can I have someone from the back end? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's more difficult in this chapter. It's more difficult to back out what exactly the problem is, yeah? It seems like it's more general exhortation that he's giving them.
Yeah, it does say from idolatry.
Okay, yeah. Chapter 10 at the front, anything you want to add? Okay, which that speaks again to the theme of pride, doesn't it, probably? Let him who thinks he's standing be careful. But let's put this in brackets, because this chapter is less addressing specific things, and it is more general. Chapter 11, what about chapter 11? Who have we got on chapter 11? Yep. Right. So why do you think he's talking about that? Do you think is it possible to work out what the problem is? Yeah. Okay. Okay, not very legible, but never mind. Yeah, that's fine. So I think the point about why he does all that about the Lord's Supper is because... sorry, were you going to say something?
Yeah, people are coming together, eating the Lord's Supper like for hunger, like they're getting drunk, and they're eating the bread as if like to take their fill. Like it says, like to eat while you recall.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be remembering Christ's sacrifice.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of issues there, haven't we? I mean the Lord's Supper, the breaking of bread, has become like some kind of party, and Paul has to address that. Chapter 12. Put your hand up if you're chapter 12. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Yep. Yeah, no, that's superb. That's great. So again, problem of disunity, which is why he's saying we're all one body. We need all these parts. Yeah. Chapter 13. Yeah. So this is an interesting example. I mean, this is a famous chapter, isn't it? The chapter about charity, the love chapter. It's not on the surface explicitly addressing a problem, but when you see it against the background of, you know, I'm smarter than you, I'm more spiritual than you, I'm part of this division, my division's better than your division, I have the right to do whatever I want, all those issues... When you take all those problems and then you see Paul now giving a chapter about the importance of love, it kind of comes into greater focus, doesn't it? Because it stands against all this, and it's as if to say, look, this is what you should be doing instead of all this other stuff that he's having to deal with. And you know, Paul would like to write. He would like to write a lot of positive stuff, like he does in chapter 13 about love, but he's got to deal with all this rubbish because there's there's so many problems in the ecclesia. That's fine on 13. On 14, well, let's call it lack of love. We're just about going to squeeze it on. Chapter 14. There must be someone at the back doing 14. Let's see what we got at the back, and then I'll come to you. Who was 14 at the back? Anybody else? Someone around here? 14. You were 14. Okay, what have you got? Okay. Yep. So let's call it misuse of spirit gifts. How's that? Anything that you wanted to add? Yep. Which sort of links a little to the Lord's Supper thing again, I suppose. Yep. I think that's good enough for that chapter. And again, I think you can see the connection of this and everything into everything else, because the spirit gifts were being used sort of as a show, yeah, a way of saying, look what I can do, look at these tongues I can speak. So again, it's a source of pride, a source of I'm better than you, instead of a tool that God has provided. Chapter 15. Yep.
Was about the resurrection.
Yep. So what's the problem?
Well, it's in the verse of the prophet. Verse 12. Now Christ be preached that he rose from the dead. How say someone among you that there is no resurrection? So some of them were saying that there was no resurrection.
Yep. Great. So disbelief in the resurrection. I'll just write resurrection for speed. And finally, chapter 16. Yeah? Is that your hand? What was your hand, was it? No, you were putting your coat on. Okay. Yeah. Were you 16?
Yeah.
Okay. Verse 17, that was it? Right, okay. Yep. There's something about the collection as well in this chapter, yeah. So you've got this collection, and he's preparing them for that. I think probably there's not he's not addressing specific problems actually in this chapter. Anyway, we need to wrap up, so let's just do that really quickly. So what we got there is a whole host of problems, more problems I think probably than in any other letter that Paul writes. He's addressing those problems again. Why would this be in the Bible? Probably because some of these problems might be relevant to attitudes that might possibly appear in Ecclesias today. And if they do, then we might look at what Paul has to say about them, and that might help us address them. So 1 Corinthians is a classic example of taking a letter and saying, well, let's see if I can work backwards to what the problem is. Let's see if I can think of any similar problems, and let's see if there's help here and to how I might deal with them. One interesting suggestion is that their error about the resurrection is actually the explanation of all these problems. And Paul actually saves the biggest problem till last. Now, that may or may not be true. There would be quite a lot of work, I suppose, to establish whether or not that was true. But it's interesting at least to consider, because once you say, well, you know, the resurrection is already past. I am, now that I've accepted Christ, I am resurrected. And we don't need some other resurrection, because I've now transcended my former life, and that means that I'm better than you, and that I can do whatever I like. That gives me a license. That false doctrine was giving them a license to say, well, I can behave however I want in terms of marriage and sex, the incest example. You know, my thing's better than yours, and so forth. So it's an interesting idea that might be connected. But the real point of today was just to say, you know, there's nothing. We've not done anything clever here, have we? We've just gradually worked through the letter, and we've said, what's going on in this chapter? What's going on in this chapter? What happens when you put all that together? What are the problems that are being addressed? What's the relevance of that for us? And that's a technique. This is the foundation for a whole load of other Bible study that you could then go on and do. But this is a technique that you can apply again and again to different parts of the scriptures. That's it. Thank you.